Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community, as Dr. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
On our show today, Adam, we'll be talking with Dr. Monique Anderson, assistant professor and cardiologist at the Duke University School of Medicine, about CPR, or cardiopulmonary resuscitation.
You know, Christy, I think we've been wanting to have this show for a long time and really quite excited to talk about something that I think all of our listeners have heard of, very few know how to do, and everyone should know.
Absolutely. But first, we have some research that matters. We're going to talk about, is restaurant food any healthier than fast food?
I hope so, but I have my doubts. We'll talk about having knee replacement surgery and that physical rehabilitation. Can it occur over the telephone versus being right there?
About opioid or pain medication overdoses linked to different levels of prescribed doses and intermittent use.
And if you or a loved one has ulcerative colitis, this inflammatory disease of the colon and small bowel, should you consider surgery as a first resort or a last resort?
All right, let's start talking about eating.
Which we both like to do.
We do.
I do more than you do.
I don't know if you like it anymore, but you probably do eat more than I do. Anyway, that's a whole other story. But we're talking about the differences in health and calories, fat intake, overall measures of people when they eat at a full-service restaurant, which you might think is healthier than the fast food restaurants like McDonald's, Hardee's, those kinds of Chick-fil-A, those kinds of places.
Yeah, and I'd be the first to say, when I were to go to the fast foods restaurants, I would think I do in general eat more calories because the two fried fish burgers and the three orders of extra French fries have more calories, more salt. I don't really do that. But the salt, the calories, the cholesterol, all of that I would know would be bad. The question is, how about when I go out to a regular restaurant? Do I eat foods that are higher in cholesterol, higher in fat, higher in calories, higher in salt?
Yeah, and I can think of a lot of reasons I would guess one or the other. But this was a study done in the European Journal of Clinical Nutrition. They look at over 18,000 adults who answered questions, and they followed them. And those who visited fast food restaurants consumed about an average of 190 more calories per day compared with people who ate at home, 11 grams more fat, 3.5 grams more saturated fat, and they followed cholesterol and sodium. And they basically found that if you compare that to eating at the full-service restaurants, all those markers for fat, saturated fat, calories, cholesterol, sodium were about the same.
Yeah. You know what I wrote when I was reading this study, Christy? I wrote, wow. I was like, whoa. And, you know, this is because I think a lot of us think perhaps that we're eating healthier when we eat out.
Well, maybe we try harder when we go to fast food restaurants. We're trying to make healthier choices. And maybe also when we're sitting down at the restaurant, we're sort of just kind of casually consuming more calories.
And in addition, they even looked at those who order out. They order the food from these full-service restaurants, but they bring it home. Now, when you do that, you tend to eat a little bit less, a little bit healthier, but not a lot. So the real question is, how do we encourage, how do we incorporate ourselves, our patients, our loved ones, families, cooking at home? That seems to be the healthiest. It's a no-brainer. We can enjoy going out, but we have to cook more at home.
It's true. All right, let's talk about something called tele-rehabilitation. So we've talked about telemedicine. We just recently had a show talking about telemedicine and trying to address some of the rural needs through that modality. But this is about rehab after a total knee replacement surgery to see if face-to-face care can be just as good as getting it over over either the telephone, video, or other means.
Yeah, because people traveling to go see a physical therapist and the time that they have to do that may be costly. It may have a lot of time. It may be a barrier. So they took patients and they randomly divided about 200 patients after hospital discharge into two groups. One got this face-to-face home visits, actually, and the other got this in-home telerehabilitation using some special video conferencing. And they looked at both at 2 months and at 4 months after discharge. How was the pain, the function, the stiffness, How was the range of motion, strength, activity, and quality of life?
And they basically found that by all of those measures, both groups did about the same, showing that the outcomes of pain, function, stiffness, range of motion, strength, activity, those things were the same if you got that instruction by video and by sort of what we call tele-rehabilitation compared with the group who got it in person. It shows some promise.
Yeah, this was published in the Journal of Bone and Joint Surgery. And one of the questions I had, Christy, is I do think that there's a role for this. So the equipment, getting the equipment set up in people's homes would be different in real life than perhaps in this study. So the results may not be the same. In addition to, if there is a cost savings, which I could hope there could be, I hope it's passed on to our patients.
I hope so too.
I would think that if it was like cheaper, but yet the cost of the procedure doesn't change, you know, so we've got to work on both things.
I agree with that. And it may not be translatable to other things, but if it's a matter of learning some exercises and doing that, then maybe there is a way to do it with the same outcomes and less cost.
Yeah, particularly for people who maybe have to travel 2-3 hours to get care, this is really important.
Absolutely. Okay, we're going to talk about these pain medicines called opioid medications. And we've talked about this on the show several times, Adam. We know that there are these risks of overdoses of people either taking too much or actually dying because of taking opioid medications. And this was a study published in the journal Medical Care looking at links between the prescription doses and frequency of use and the risk of overdose.
And they actually looked at data on patients on Medicaid who were taking opioids and had bad outcomes in Washington State between 2006 and 2010 and identified over 2,200 opioid overdoses occurring in over 1,800 patients. And a large number of them occurred in the sorts of things that we're all now intervening on to reduce and be more a little more stringent about people on chronic opioid therapy getting high doses, too high a doses. But there was a little bit of a surprising finding here, which I found interesting and important.
Yeah. So Washington State did introduce these state opioid guidelines in 2007. And the good news, they focused on the overdose in chronic long-term users. And they did find that there was a decrease in the overall overdose rate after passing those guidelines. So that was a good news. But there were some surprising results of what percent of those were chronic users versus infrequent users.
Yeah. Only 44% of the patients who overdosed were chronic users. And in contrast, almost a third of the overdose patients had relatively low doses of the opioids. And if they took one of these opiate pain medicines with a sedative like a sleeping pill
or an anxiety pill, like a benzo pill,
it was a factor in almost half of the patients. It suggests that, oh boy, we better be aware and take into consideration and perhaps really reduce those types of situations. We're missing a lot of potential opioid intoxication deaths. We got to do a better job.
We absolutely do. The next thing we can do a better job with is considering surgery earlier for our patients with ulcerative colitis. So you mentioned before, Adam, ulcerative colitis is that disease that can affect the bowel where you get inflammation and irritation that can cause diarrhea, cramping, pain, and rectal bleeding.
So this was research that was in the Annals of Internal Medicine, and they looked at over 800 patients who had had elective surgery. At the University of Pennsylvania analyzed this data from Medicare and Medicaid, and these patients had their colon removed. And then they looked at 7,500 patients who took medicine, and they looked at the outcomes comparing those two. And they found that in contrast to maybe their expectation that surgery would have worse outcomes because you maybe took surgery for the people with worse diseases, actually, surgery had a 33% reduced risk of death compared to the medication on the operations that were performed over 11 years from 2000 to 2011.
Mm-hmm. So it really suggests that surgery should be considered earlier in the course of disease and maybe not just as the last resort. So if you or a loved one has ulcerative colitis, that's something you should talk with your doctor about.
Yeah, I think that it will certainly get us thinking about the shared decision-making and not presenting it as the last alternative, maybe not the first. but certainly to have this conversation. Well, that'll conclude the Research That Matters, Christy. We've had a good chance to talk about consideration of surgery for ulcerative colitis,
about opioid overdoses being linked to lower prescribed doses and other sedative medications,
about rehabilitation after knee replacements, possibly using tele-rehab as a new modality,
and that we should all try to eat at home more. Restaurant food is not much healthier than fast food.
Let's invite each other over each other's homes.
I know, we should.
You got to cook first, though.
Oh, that's a problem. Okay, well, that concludes the Research That Matters portion of our show. We're going to take a short break, but when we come back, Adam and I will be talking with Dr. Monique Anderson, assistant professor and cardiologist at the Duke University School of Medicine, about CPR. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Bob Gwyther. Today on Conversations, Bob, we're talking with Dr. Monique Anderson, assistant professor and cardiologist at Duke University Medical Center, about CPR, or cardiopulmonary resuscitation.
Welcome, Dr. Anderson. Thank you for being with us today.
Thank you for the opportunity, Adam and Bob.
You know, one thing we always like to know is a little bit about the person behind the program and the ideas. Tell us a little bit about your journey to cardiology and medicine and how you got interested in this whole particular topic of CPR.
That's a great question. So my parents tell the story of me always wanting to be a doctor. And I remember at the age of 8 sort of thinking about the heart for the first time because my father had a heart attack at the age of 38. And his brother had cardiac arrest at the age of 51. But it wasn't until I cared for a patient in the critical care unit who had an amazing story that really piqued my interest in this topic as a field of study.
What was that story? You piqued our interest.
So this is a patient who doesn't mind me sharing her name, and she's gotten to tell her story a lot. But her name was Stacy Lee. She was 47 at the time. It was 2011. She was driving with her mother-in-law to go exercise and felt dizzy. She got out of the car and dropped to the ground. Her mother-in-law was 85 years old. She couldn't start CPR, so she laid on her horn. And a young man ran out. That young man did not know CPR. And he ran on the inside of the facility and grabbed someone who did. It happened to be a firefighter who went on to start CPR 5 minutes after she dropped to the ground. She received CPR for 30 minutes there, 45 minutes in the Duke ER, and was literally a vegetable for more than a month at Duke. We thought she would not survive, would not have a meaningful survival. And to my surprise, a few months later, the family brought her back to meet me in surprise in the critical care unit, where she was walking, talking, laughing. And we were really sort of thinking, wow, what a miracle. So
wow.
That really piqued my interest in this field.
What an amazing, amazing experience and story. What a great way to get piqued interest.
Yeah, my son is a paramedic and does his stuff for a living too, and he's had a few stories like that. Though, unfortunately, most of the stories are the other way around. So there was this piece about you in the News and Observer that I'm sure you have seen that gave it to us before this about CPR. And I know it's your research interest, but it's also practically interesting to you. And you had what we all dread, which is going to a professional meeting and having your colleague, in your case, cardiologist, go into cardiac arrest right in the hotel, and you had to deal with it.
Yeah. May I take a step back and talk about what cardiac arrest is? Because what we know is that cardiac arrest is commonly confused with a heart attack, and the two are distinct. So cardiac arrest is when the heart stops due to a dangerous or malignant heart rhythm, and it's a rhythm that's incompatible with life. So that patient drops to the ground immediately and have really only a few minutes to receive help before they are at risk of dying. We know that only 10% of patients survive cardiac arrest because there's only a critical window to do something about it. Myocardial infarction, on the other hand, is when an artery carrying blood or nutrients or oxygen to the heart become occluded, and that leads to immediate chest pain. And it's very important to go to the hospital in a timely manner, but it's not the same as cardiac arrest, although a heart attack can lead to cardiac arrest.
Those two things could occur at the same time, but they don't necessarily need to. And I think one of the things, and I know Christy and I, Bob, have talked about on the show, research that shows sudden death occurs more frequently than people recognize, and it's not always the predictable person who's sedentary, who smokes, who has high blood pressure, who has diabetes. It can happen to a lot of people, and that's the group a lot of times that seems that could intervene, maybe save their life. I don't know if that's wrong, but that's how we've talked about it.
I think that's a great point. What I tell anyone when I give a talk is that cardiac arrest can really happen to anyone. And although we know some of the prominent risk factors, we're not very good at predicting who's going to have cardiac arrest, which is why the community response is so important.
You know, one of the things I do want to hear about the stories, but one of my colleagues was driving down a road in Chapel Hill a few years ago, and he's a radiation oncologist, and he saw someone running, you know, and fell down. He pulled off the side of the road, and same thing, and did CPR. And this was someone who obviously was physically active. So how often does things like this happen in, like, what's, for instance, runners? Is this something that runners actually should be concerned about?
Well, we don't know that it's more associated with runners. We know that in terms of marathon runners, there's a sort of minimally increased risk of having a cardiac arrest event. We know that at the end of a marathon, somebody will get in trouble with cardiac arrest. But I wouldn't say that runners are more likely to have cardiac arrest, although we do know that exercise has been a common place for cardiac arrest occurrence.
You push yourself too hard, too fast, and too hot of weather.
And from what I
understand, that's certainly true.
From what I understand, it is also when you go exercise to the max, and then you go flop on a couch instead of walking it off, your heart can be more vulnerable.
I don't know that to be true, but I don't know it to be untrue. I think it's always a good idea to get off of a treadmill, for example, and walk it off and slow down first.
So tell us, what is CPR then? Because we now really, I think, are quite in tune with someone falls down, they collapse, and you may think, are they breathing? Is their heart running or not? What is CPR?
So cardiopulmonary resuscitation is, I think the bigger term are interventions applied to restore blood flow. But for purposes of the general public, it's chest compression only CPR. And we really switched from breaths and compressions in 2010 to compressions.
Oh, wait. Breaths and compressions. Explain that for a second. It just went right over my head.
So in 2010, we alternated. We trained the public to alternate between providing breaths and doing chest compression.
Right, two breaths, 10 compressions. There was some
2 to 30. So
two to
we
30,
were
yes,
we
okay.
were breathing form, and we were their heart. We were pumping blood to the rest of the body with our compressions. Well, there's an acknowledgement that in the general public, we get afraid. We don't remember how to do it. It's kind of complicated. What's that ratio? We just can't remember it. So in 2010, we switched to recommending compression-only CPR. And the way I remember it is the slogan, call 911, push hard and fast. So the first thing you should do when you see someone who's not responding other than touching them and saying, hey, are you okay? When you realize that they're not waking up, call 911 or send someone else to call 911. And then get on the center of the chest and compress. We say at a rate of 100 times per minute. And famously, the Bee Gees song Stayin' Alive is how we remember the tempo to providing those chest compressions.
Are you going to sing us a version? only if we're we have to all we'll all pitch in. Yeah.
Well, I only know like the part that I remember, but.
And the notion is that a person's got enough oxygen in their blood that all you need is a chest compression.
That's absolutely right, Bob. In general, we believe that that out-of-hospital cardiac arrest victims have about 10 minutes of adequate oxygenation. So, and we're also providing oxygenated blood as we're doing the chest compressions.
We're going to take a short break first, but when we return, we're going to continue talking with our guest, Dr. Monique Anderson, assistant professor and cardiologist at Duke University Medical Center, about CPR, or cardiopulmonary resuscitation. We'll be right back with Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Bob Gwyther. Stay with us.
Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Bob Gwyther. Bob, we've been talking to Dr. Monique Anderson, assistant professor and cardiologist at Duke University Medical Center, about cardiopulmonary resuscitation. And just before the break, Dr. Anderson, you were talking about these new guidelines, perhaps making it easier to remember, perhaps reducing some resistance to people wanting to perhaps do mouth-to-mouth resuscitation. Are these guidelines working? And how often actually are people willing to get involved? Because that seems like to be a big issue.
So that's a great question. And I would say absolutely. And we've seen that here in North Carolina. Our group recently published a paper in JAMA over the past few weeks showing the impact of a quality improvement program called Heart Rescue over the last 4 years between 2010 and the end of 2013. And what we've realized is that bystander CPR has increased more than 50%. So it increased from 39% to about 50% through quality improvement efforts. And that's by teaching chest compression only CPR. So populations are remembering it. We still have work to do, but they are remembering it and they are doing it. Now, defibrillation or AEDs, automatic external defibrillators, are often needed but unavailable for the largest segment of populations that have cardiac arrest. So cardiac arrest occurs in the home in 80% of cases, 20% occur in the public. There's much more likely to be an AED in public settings. And we've even seen that there's been a tremendous increase in the use of first responder AEDs. So first responders are police officers, firefighters, those segments of the populations trained to respond to emergencies, but not healthcare providers like paramedics, like your son, Bob.
Mm-hmm. What about, I know you do research. Mm-hmm. What are the areas of research that need to be done here that your group is involved in? Because I'm certain, as in most things in medicine, there are more unanswered questions than unanswered questions. What don't we know, and what are you doing?
Well, there's a lot we don't know, and I think that that's a great thing. So, interestingly, the Institute of Medicine has gotten very involved in trying to understand how we improve survival from cardiac arrest, and they got together a lot of experts to talk about this. And what we realized is, one, we need a workable definition of cardiac arrest. Some patients may expectedly die while others unexpectedly die. The other thing we need is a national registry to actually track cardiac arrest. This is surprising, but we probably don't have knowledge of who has cardiac arrest over a lot of segments in the U.S. population. So they have called for a national registry. We're very, very grateful here. And that due to some of the efforts at Duke, we now have a registry that collects data on all cardiac arrests in the North Carolina, in the state of North Carolina.
And who facilitates that? The 911 services?
EMS agencies, 911 services, and hospitals are all participating in sending their data to these registries, but it's largely coordinated by EMS agencies.
Wow.
And what about the training? Because, I can imagine a lot of people, they'd like to help, but do they actually need training? Because could you do it wrong? Could you hurt someone?
So my biggest advice to everyone listening on this call is to remember that you can't hurt them. They are dead. The only thing you can do is help them by doing CPR. Further, there are Good Samaritan laws protecting you as the person who helped that victim. So no, there's nothing you can do wrong, and there's no lawsuit that could be brought against you for helping to resuscitate someone who's dead.
So if you don't do it, they're going to die.
They're going to die.
If you do perform it, you may save a life.
You could save a life.
That's pretty good risk benefit.
That's exactly right. You know, we know in the hospital that to do effective CPR, you're going to hear ribs crack, and that's frightening for some people. But it happens, and it actually means you're doing it, and it's great. Keep going.
Mm-hmm. I was real curious in reading this News and Observer article about your meeting and resuscitating this colleague. I'm wondering if you'd share a little bit about that with us.
Sure. So I had the great fortune of giving a large presentation on the impact of in-hospital cardiac arrest throughout the United States. And a few hours after that presentation, I was actually at a JAMA event, a Journal of the American Association event, where I was actually talking about some of my research. And I was with my mentor, Eric Peterson, who's the director of the Duke Clinical Research Institute. And we were all walking out as a group. And it's funny because we were actually joking about cardiac arrest. And I looked across the hall. It was more than 200 yards away. And there was a person laying face down. And I literally said, is this a joke? We couldn't treat it as a joke, obviously. Eric and I took off running, and the people behind us did as well. We got to him, checked a pulse, turned him over. He was blue, injured. He had a deep gash on his chin and was rigid. I actually thought he was dead, and I got to tell you, I was afraid. This was the first time I was performing CPR outside of the hospital where I'm so comfortable doing it. But for me, this was a colleague who was in trouble. So we initiated CPR and was very lucky that that after a few rounds, he stood bolt upright or tried to sit bolt upright and said, I'm okay. It was really scary.
What a great story. So I should say this probably teaches you to not be laughing after a presentation.
Or a joke. Yes. As someone said, this was the perfect joke for you. If it had been a joke, it was the perfect joke to end your day. But I'm so glad.
You mentioned that you do CPR in the hospital routinely, but what you're really talking about here is not the in-hospital CPR. Distinguish for our listeners why that's different in the hospital compared to perhaps in the community.
Well, so in the hospital, cardiac arrest resuscitation is just so well coordinated. We have teams that are trained to respond really fast. We're putting in invasive lines. We have very advanced equipment to treat it right away, and survival is higher as a result of it.
Though those patients are also sicker, right? So a lot of those patients aren't going to survive just because they're sicker.
They are sicker, but 24% of them survive compared to 10% out of the hospital. Hmm. Out of the hospital, obviously, we're pretty limited in the beginning, which is why it is so important for the general population to know CPR, because they make a difference. They can more than double survival by getting treatment started until EMS arrives and is able to initiate advanced cardiac life support, and they're able to do defibrillation more readily as well.
I'm wondering what you think about whether society ought to invest in a lot of defibrillators to make them even more widely available than they are now.
Yes, The answer is yes.
I mean, I was watching James Bond, a rerun, and James got poisoned with digitalis, and he was able to get out to his car in time, and he had a little portable defibrillator that he – but, you know, to put it on yourself and to do it to yourself on the right thing, I think that's more and beyond. But this idea of technology and maybe iPhones and others, is that possible in the future?
I think the – yes, absolutely. I see two great benefits for wearable technology. My hope is that we're able to predict cardiac arrest with wearable technologies. We're able to figure out when a patient may be in trouble or not. And the second is with geospatial mapping, that we can figure out where cardiac arrests are occurring and direct people who know CPR to those locations.
Wow, that's not in the into the future. That sounds like it's ready for prime time. You know, we're going to need to wrap up, but we would be remiss. First off, we should thank you, Dr. Monique Anderson, for coming in and describing, I think, the optimism and hope to a situation that sometimes may feel hopeless. So thank you so much for doing that.
Thank you.
And we've been talking with Dr. Monique Anderson, assistant professor of cardiologist at Duke University Medical Center, about CPR, and we couldn't resist this. Woo, 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 staying alive, staying alive. Woo, 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 staying alive.
Way to go, Bob. And we now know the exact pace that we should be doing. Thank you so much for being our guest.
Thank you.
Coming up, a short break, but coming up on
House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Bob Gwaither.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Call segment of our show today, Adam and I get to spend a few minutes talking about your health questions and your concerns.
If any listener has a question or concern they'd like us to address on an upcoming show, you can send your comments to yourhealth@unc.edu. And we'd like to ask our excellent executive producer, Daniel Lane, to read us our very first House Call question. Daniel?
I'm a 48-year-old male who is a little overweight and not very active physically. Otherwise, I feel great. I don't take any medications. Most of my family is also well. The last time I saw a doctor was 3 years ago. Do I need to have a physical exam?
And no, Christy, this does not describe me.
Like,
I know
Adam,
you were just
you?
Thinking, is this our doctor? You know why it's not me?
Why?
I'm not 48.
I know.
And I
it was
am
a compliment,
a little more
Adam.
Physically active. I don't think I'm overweight. But, you know, there's a lot of males out there that this does describe.
Absolutely. And, you know, so it's been 3 years since you've gone in to see a doctor and you're 48 years old. And even though you say you don't have a lot of medical problems, you may have some, like high blood pressure or even being overweight is a medical problem. The fact that you're overweight and not very active physically put you at risk for developing problems that you might not know about, like diabetes or high blood pressure, that you would only know about if you go in to have a physical exam.
In addition to which, you may have an elevated cholesterol. You may have what's called metabolic profile. Sounds kind of ominous, and it is, because it's a whole constellation of things that would suggest your risk of heart disease is much higher. In addition to which, we probably could have lots of things that you may not even identify you probably want to talk about, including doing a full-body skin
alcohol.
Exam. So Christy and I are both, you know, I know that this could be a little controversial in the literature, but we think it's probably good for you. We'd both recommend it.
And also just to have a connection, have a primary care doctor. If it's been more than 3 years, it's hard to know, really, who is that person. So to go in and have somebody who knows your medical history and is giving you advice, even periodically, is worth it.
And if you're a spouse out there and this describes your husband, please encourage them to make that appointment or vice versa.
Yep. Okay, let's take our next House Call question. Daniel?
I have a finger that for the last 2 years periodically turns blue on the underside. It does not hurt, but it does swell a little bit, and for several days it almost looks like I have a bruise. After the swelling goes down, it is normal again for several months. It does not appear to be related to cold, heat, and I'm otherwise really healthy. No other fingers or joints have a problem. Do you have an idea what this could be?
I heard this, and at first I thought, oh, maybe this is a Raynaud's type of syndrome, which where some people get blue fingers. It's related to cold or heat. But this it sounds different because it's just one finger and just in that one spot.
Yeah, there's. It makes us think about, you know, we think about all kinds of things. You could have a clot in that finger, or you could have
That would be unusual.
Unusual, but it could. But embolic clot, where we see people with strokes, they present. But we think the really bad things. And I guess the question is, in this particular case, is there something not bad? And Christy, I've come up with something.
Okay. Tell me what it is.
I've researched the literature on this particular one. And I think that this could be spontaneous blue finger syndrome.
That does not sound real.
It is real. There are only about 3 or 4 dozen case reports in the entire world, but maybe our health science librarians can put up the link about some case reports. But it's totally benign. And for reasons we don't understand, patients get just like this patient's talking about. Their finger on one side can get blue. It's not painful. There's nothing else wrong. So I think in this particular case, we would encourage you to see your doctor. Have them look into it, but you might have to tell your doctor, is it spontaneous blue finger syndrome?
Spontaneous blue finger syndrome.
We'll put a picture up there. You be the judge.
It sounds a little out there, but hopefully that is what this is, because it's rare and it's benign, meaning it won't have, other bad outcomes for you. So I hope that that is the case.
You know who wrote up this case report? Actually, it came from Mass General Hospital. We know it has to be true. House would have already had it on Dr. House. And, if you're going to get answer already, that or Jeopardy, you got your answer already.
There it is. All right. Let's take our next one, Daniel.
I have had high blood pressure, depression, and anxiety for 2 decades. After my mother died last year from dementia, I started going back to church regularly for the first time in a decade. Today, my blood pressure is good. I have less anxiety, pain, and depression. I feel guilty as it was so hard to care for my mother, but I also feel better too. Is this normal?
Well, I think this is a really important comment, question from a listener, Christy, that I know is probably near and dear to both of us.
It is. And, we're sorry to hear that that you had the passing of your mom and that you had a hard time taking care of her. And that is common, that caring for a loved one with dementia is really difficult. And so it's not uncommon for people, once you've gotten through that time in your life, as you're starting to be able to take care of yourself now and reconnect at church and tend to your spiritual health and other aspects of your health, that you may feel better in some ways. Some people feel relieved in some ways or have a sense of peace knowing that you gave your best to your mom, but now she's moved on to the afterlife.
And one thing I'll say is, you gave great care, it sounds like, and don't ever feel guilty about giving great care. Feel good about that, and feel good that your blood pressure, your anxiety, depression are all better now, and feel good that you're finding a community within the spiritual community, because those are all really good things. Mm-hmm. You don't need guilt in your life, and so I'm thinking this is a wonderful message for all of us to, when we're doing good, hard work, sometimes God's work, depending on how one thinks about it, and it doesn't, people will die, and you'll be able to move on and keep that memory and also share it in ways that ultimately now are available for all of our listeners.
And that's probably what your mom wants for you, is to feel happy and be well and have that sense of peace. So thank you for sharing this. I think this will really touch a lot of our listeners who have gone through similar experiences.
Daniel, what's our very last house call?
I get pain medication from my doctor pretty rarely, about once every 4 months, and I occasionally get medicine to help with anxiety, also pretty rarely, about once every 6 months. I've been doing this for years without any problems. Recently, my doctor said that she would no longer give me both medicines, as she thought it was risky, and I had to start taking drug screenings too. This seems like an overboard response. Perhaps it is time to find a new doctor who is more in tune with my needs.
Well, that is a tough situation from a patient perspective, and one that you should open, as we always encourage you to talk directly with your doctor about those concerns. Just because of the research that matters that we talked about earlier in the show, Adam, we know that prescribing these pain medications and also prescribing certain types of anxiety medications really does increase the risk for our patients having overdose, intoxication, and even death. And so there is more of an emphasis now of us having standard approaches to test everyone to be sure that we're approaching things with a standard approach and in a way that's safe.
Yeah, change is always difficult.
Uh-huh.
And you have a stable kind of way of getting medicine that you like and has worked for you, but it's not working for the doctor you're with now. And I don't necessarily think that means that you should get a new doctor. The reality is, I think you'll find that many, if not most, doctors increasingly are moving to this. So I'd say have the open conversation with your doctor, but recognize that these changes are meant to improve your health. And while it may not seem that at front obvious to you, hopefully it will over time.
We appreciate your question and wish you all the best as you navigate that with your doctor. Thank you for your questions today. Thank you for joining us today for Your Health. We hope we've addressed some issues and concerns that are important to you in your health. And we want you to share your questions, share your stories. Email us at yourhealth@unc.edu.
You can visit us online at yourhealthradio.org, follow us on Twitter, Facebook, iTunes, or search our health app, Your Health, one word, for a free download.
We want to thank the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship, and our guest today, Dr. Monique Anderson. We hope you'll join us next time on Your Health.
On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And I'm Dr. Christy Page, and we'll look forward to talking with you again next week. Take care.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your Health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine.